Founders Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Ellen Cochran, author of Follow the Water. Ellen is a former middle school teacher of English, English learners, Spanish, and Russian. She studied science writing at Johns Hopkins, is a certified California naturalist, and previously wrote a syndicated column exploring the natural world. Now Ellen lives in Sacramento, where she champions literacy, nature education, and conservation. A portion of the proceeds from Follow the Water supports the Panguana Foundation, which we will be learning about as we talk about this book. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Ellen.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's just start with sort of an overview of what Follow the Water is about.
Follow the Water is one of the most extraordinary survival stories of the last century. A 17-year-old girl, maybe 110 pounds soaking wet, ended up in an airplane over the Amazon that was struck by lightning. The plane's wing fell off. She was over the middle of uninhabited Amazon. The plane broke apart around her, and she was thrown 2 miles in the air above the jungle, strapped to her seat. Seat fell, broke through all of the overstory, crashed into the Amazon jungle floor. She was injured. She was all alone. She was the sole survivor. And in 11 days, this youngster worked her way out of the Amazon to safety.
That is really amazing. And I mean, just the idea that she survived the fall.
It is. And the book is written fifth grade to high school level. And one of the things I did was try to explain the science behind a lot of the instances that happened. One of the most extraordinary things is, how did she survive that fall? And she was strapped to her seat. And the seat next to her had been the seat where her mother was sitting, and her mother was ejected out of her seat. So it was an empty seat strapped next to her. And people have analyzed it, think that in the turbulent air, cold and hot air, she got a little bit of lift, and then she started to spin, much like a maple leaf seed will spin in the fall when it comes off a tree. And that helped her. And then the rainforest is filled with trees that are more than 150 feet tall in some places, and it's believed that they acted as like a little spring bed, broke her fall, and placed her on the ground roughly. She was very injured, but it did save her life.
One of the other amazing things is how her injuries didn't really, like, she was able to walk and to swim and to move with some pretty severe injuries.
I am not a doctor, but I have researched the idea of shock suppressing a lot of reactions, both psychological and physiological, after you're injured. And if you are in a situation, there are times when the body and the mind will do extraordinary things. And I believe it was the case with her, that she maybe didn't even realize how severely she was injured, but she was in shock mode, and she had one purpose, and that was to try, first of all, to find her mother, if possible, and then to get out of the jungle.
And the title of the book, Follow the Water, The Unbelievable True Story of a Teenager's Survival in the Amazon. So following the water was really the key, wasn't it, for her?
It was. The tributaries, the rivers, they are trails, in effect. But she was raised by scientist parents. Her father and her mother had lived with her in the jungle and instructed her on basic survival skills. She knew how to start fires. She knew what to eat, what not to eat, and very importantly, what to touch and what not to touch. But one of the lessons that her father gave her was, if you're ever lost in the wilderness, really lost, not just, I think I can't find my way out, find water and follow it, because water eventually, even if it starts small, will lead to civilization and people.
Right, right. Of course, in the jungle, and you describe this really well in the book. You can't just walk along the side of the stream, along the side of the stream,
I know exactly what you're referring to.
Yeah.
We're so used to groomed trails and being able to go many amazing places here. But this is untouched wilderness in this part of the Amazon jungle. There were indigenous tribes in the general area, but they did not establish in this area. So there were no even rough footpaths where she fell. And yeah, you cannot walk along the edge. She eventually found enough deep water and then a river where she got into the river and paddled her way to go forward. So that's how she was able to use it as a path.
Which was safer than at the beginning when it was a very small stream. She could walk in it. It wasn't very deep, but she had to be so careful about where she stepped.
Oh, amazingly careful. One of the extraordinary things about this is after she fell and she came to consciousness, she assessed herself and she had on a mini dress. It was summer at that time. And she had on a watch and a ring and one shoe. And that's all she had. And she opted to keep the shoe, understanding, yes, you have to be so careful where you step there. Many, many dangerous insects and snakes. One of the most poisonous snakes in the world, the Bushmaster, is in its natural habitat where she fell. So she really had to use that foot as a exploratory poke to make sure that she didn't step on anything. And the amazing thing is she kept that sandal. And she kept the sandal going all through the forest and the water. And even to this day, she has kept the mini dress that she was wearing. She's a much older woman now. She's in her 70s. So it's interesting, though, that she still has the dress.
Now, were you able to talk to her as you were writing this?
When this happened, it was 1971, but extraordinarily and horribly for her, she was faced with enormous paparazzi type effect when it happened. Even so bad that people who had read about the story would come up and try and touch her and, want to know about the spirituality or the reasons that she survived and everybody else perished. It was so bad that she had to leave Peru and go back to Germany. And that started a trend for her not speaking to the press. She has decided to open up and support the foundation, the Panguana Foundation, that was established initially by her parents and that she now runs. She opened up more, gave interviews, and then again, shut the door basically and wouldn't speak pretty much to anybody about what was going on. A few years ago, it was the 50th anniversary of the fall, and she spoke to a New York Times reporter, a very famous one. But it was interesting because the interview she gave statements and information that she has oft given in interviews. There was nothing new. I reached out to her, to her agent, and to the Panguana Foundation, and she would not speak to me. However, the foundation is lovely, and they gave me communication and information, and that's how I started and decided that I would donate to the foundation 10% of the book proceeds. I felt very fortunate to become published. I've been writing most of my life, but I never had a book deal, and I felt very fortunate to have a book deal after a long career as a teacher. I had retired, and I thought, well, this, is an opportunity to pay it forward. Ultimately, this is not my story. It's Julianne's, and I did everything I could to make it as accurate as possible. When a journalist and a writer is faced with not having a principal to talk to, it is a challenge. So I had to circle all around her, find any scientists, any people who would talk to me about the situation, about what actually happened, and also about the science behind it. Mm. And I speak Spanish conversationally and can read it. So it was in Peru, so I was able to get sources from the time that explain what happened and do further research that way. So I did everything I could, but unfortunately, she would not actually speak to me.
Ah, well, I guess I can understand with, she was so young, and it was such a to have that degree of attention. And you write in the book about it wasn't all positive attention either. You know, there was all kinds of rumors and...
Yes, she's a sole survivor. And there were 92 souls on that plane. And one of them was her mother. And the rest of the people on the plane, it was Christmas Eve. And it was joyous at the beginning. People were going back home to spend time with their loved ones. And then this tragedy happened. And the families of the survivors couldn't believe that this one person survived, and thought initially, well, if this young, slight girl could survive, maybe my loved one could. And when it became clear that nobody else survived, there was a sense of, why her and not my loved one? Which I think is, you know, a natural human reaction, but a pretty daunting way of thinking about it. And hard for her to deal with as a youngster, I think.
Absolutely. And yet she still stayed with her original desire to work and study in the Amazon. You know, I could have seen that it might have like turned her away from that completely.
She went back to Germany, and that's where her upper degree education was. But every chance she got to go back to Panguana and Peru and the Amazon, she did. And she continued her studies there, first studying butterflies and then delving deep for her PhD into the bats of Panguana, which is a fascinating study. She spent a lot of time on foot going through the area, studying bats, finding species, and at night curling up in little cubby holes she would make in the forest. Very, very brave person, but in some ways, I think of it as it was her backyard. She grew up there in her years, and also the attachment she had for the area because of her parents. When the parents started the foundation, they were actually able to purchase some of the land, which is, you know, kind of unusual in a foreign country. And they were German citizens, and they had owned the section, and the tragedy struck, and she and her father still maintained the property in a stewardship. After her father died, she became the director, and every year she has expanded acre by acre, making it more of an international draw and a beautifully preserved and conserved place in the Peruvian Amazon. I do have to say that recently there's been some threat to the area. I don't know if our listeners are aware, but gold mining is a very serious problem in the Amazon. Poverty strikes many people there, and it's seen as an opportunity to elevate themselves out of poverty. So they pursue gold mining, which is very bad for the environment because they use mercury to extract it. And they've started gold mining more in the north region. It used to be concentrated more in the south. And it has come to the edge of Panguana. And recently, some of the more criminal type element who are armed fired shots at scientists that were in Panguana, so they had to close down the research station. They're in the process of trying to work with the government to reopen it, but right now it's a little bit chaotic.
Wow. Can other people go to Panguana, or just you have to be invited as a research scientist?
You have to be invited as a research scientist, but there previously, before this tragedy about the violence happened, if you were someone who was writing something specific, you could apply to go. And it might have actually turned into a place where people, you know, who wanted to have that type of very rugged experience could have gone.
Ecotourists.
Right. Yeah. Well, I doubt it will ever be an ecotourist type situation, because the rigor and the scientific study is extreme there.
It's not easy even to this day to get there.
But oh, no.
But what was it like to get there in Julianne's day?
That's a really good question. Well, they would land in a town called Pucaipa, which is a town in the Amazon. They would get into four-wheel drives, and they would bump along roads many, many miles. And then they would get in canoes, and they would canoe with all their supplies, again, many miles until they reached the area where Panguana is. And then from there, they would have to haul all their stuff back to the station.
Wow.
And if you can imagine, sunny weather is not usually what you find in the Amazon. It usually is raining, wet, and difficult, muddy.
And of course, Julianne had more appropriate clothes with her to change into as soon as she landed. And I got to admit, knowing what this was, what was going to happen, when she gets on the plane in that mini dress, I'm just cringing.
Oh,
It's
I
like.
know. It makes you think about when you travel, you always be, what's the best thing to wear when I
I
travel?
know, I know. And of course, back then it was common to sort of dress up to get on a plane. And now it's not, and some people are don't like that, but I think being prepared for whatever happens is maybe more
Yes.
important. Now, this plane that they got on was with an airline that had a really, really bad safety record. And that was shocking to me that they were even allowed to keep operating.
Well, it's 54 years ago, I believe, in 71. And looking back about air safety and standards, they were much lower in the United States. And then in places where you're, basically hopping over mountains to go into jungle towns, the safety standards were even lower. It was a Lockheed Electra, which is the same type of plane that Amelia Earhart actually flew on. And this one was, of course, completely equipped and modified as a passenger airplane. And the pilots would have navigated quite easily and probably even would have gotten through that thunderstorm. I imagine they were very, very experienced, having flown over the Amazon many times. But it was just one of those freak experiences where it was a huge thunderstorm and lightning struck right on the wing.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, and I learned from your book that back then the fuel was not as sort of protected as it is now, and so it actually exploded.
I talk to a lot of children and go to school visits to talk about this experience. And I always make sure to talk about lightning strikes and today all of the safety effects that are in place for commercial airlines, just because I don't want to terrify the children after I tell them the story. And it is pretty amazing. We are very safe. The planes are pretty frequently struck by lightning, but you pretty much don't notice it because of the safety. The book was really interesting to write because I was telling it for a younger audience. It's told in a timeline, start to finish type of method. But I have a lot of what I call sidebars throughout the book that explain what happened and why it happened and the science behind it, plus the natural history. And one of the things I focus on is are planes safe today? And why did this plane crash? So I
Right.
think kids want to know the truth, and they like honesty. They don't like things sugarcoated. They don't want to repeatedly read things that are frightening, but they want to know what happened, what really happened.
Another thing that you talk about, one of your sidebars is about the fact, she had almost nothing to eat for those 11 days, right? She had a bag of hard candies that she
That's right.
pieced out day by day, and then why she couldn't, what would have happened if she had, once she was rescued, was given too much to eat. I had no idea.
Yes, I'm in California in Sacramento, and up in the Sierra Nevada. It's not too far from us is where the Donner Party was laid over during that horrible winter. And I've read quite a bit about the Donner Party, and one of the bad things that happened was when they brought down some of the families to Sutter's Fort here in Sacramento. They, of course, fed them and they didn't overfeed them. But during the night, one of the young boys got up and got into the food and he ended up killing himself because he ate too much food. I know after such a horrible idea to be rescued and then the horrible irony of dying from food. So, anyway, back to Julianne. She crashed. She was a healthy weight when she crashed, and she knew after she assessed the area that I better find something to eat. And she first found a panettone, I think that's how you pronounce it, the Italian cake that people have at Christmas a lot, that it was covered with mud. And so she wasn't starving at that point. She dismissed it and said, "Oh, I don't want that. That's too muddy. It's too icky." She passed on it, did find a bag of candy. But after that, no suitcases, nothing. The breakup had spread the plane over many miles. And so where she was, just one bag of candy. And that's all she had for 11 days. Now, water was another issue. Water was all around her, but she knew that it was riddled with bacteria and potentially dangerous viruses, but she had to drink, and so she did. And one of the repercussions for her later was she did get hepatitis presented after she had moved back to Germany, actually many months later, and she did have some bacterial infections.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Ellen Cochran, author of Follow the Water. Ellen, what drew you to the story of Julianne?
I think my story, well, it's not as extreme as Julianne. It is about perseverance because I've always been a writer and kept journals as a kid, went on to write magazine articles and have a full teaching career. But after I stopped my teaching career, I did retire a little bit early, but I decided to go back and get my master's degree. And it was around COVID. And like everybody, in the United States, if you were healthy and locked down, you started cleaning your house out. So when I was 17, and when I was 17 myself, I was an exchange student in Peru. I lived in Lima, where Julianne had lived, and I traveled the same air flight over the jungle that she did. Luckily, I didn't have an accident like Julianne, but I relived all my experiences there. And I realized that at that time, way back in 1979, I had actually researched Peru before I went there and had come across an article about her and just tucked it in my pocket and never thought about it again. Fast forward all these years, I'm in the master's program and I approached my advisor and asked, would it be appropriate to perhaps write a book about this? And they were all for it. I did it and I got the master's. And then I connected with Highlights. They have many writers' workshops. And I went to their science writing workshop. And I, through a series of connections, I connected with an agent who took me on and sold the book.
Wow, well, congratulations.
Thank you. And it's a start of a new career. And I am on the, shall we say, the south side of 50. I just want to be encouraging to any writers out there, and anybody who has long-held dreams of any type, there's always something fresh and wonderful to do. And even though we're getting older, it's still very vibrant, very interesting, creative time.
Wow. Well, yeah, of course. Remember Grandma Moses?
Absolutely.
I was actually fascinated by her when I was a kid. And I don't know why, but I think I remember doing a school project on Grandma Moses. So now I'm not, I don't know how old she was when she actually started painting and started getting attention, but I'm probably not too far from it now.
Yeah, humans are, well, like Julianne, we're amazingly resilient. And as long as your heart's beating, you got a lot to do.
So you were an exchange student in Lima, and which is fairly exotic for the 1970s. How did you end up there?
There's an organization called the American Field Service, and at that time they were very prominent in most public high schools. They'd have clubs or information about their exchange programs. And I applied for their exchange program, and you don't choose where you're going to be selected to go to, but I went to Lima, Peru, and lived with a wonderful family and experienced the culture, the country, and the region. It was an amazing experience. I was there for 10 weeks, and I learned some basic Spanish, and
So you
it
didn't
was
know Spanish before you went?
I had high school Spanish,
Okay.
means I didn't know Spanish. But I'd been introduced to the basic concepts.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So 10 weeks. And have you ever gone back?
I have not gone back to Peru. I plan to go back. I've been to many countries in Central America. But yes, it's on my list to go back.
Do you have a, if someone were just like had never been to Central South America, where would you advise them to go first?
Peru is actually a pretty amazing place to go because, like California, it has almost all of the major ecological regions. You can go to tip top of the mountains and freeze, and they have deserts, and then of course the beautiful Pacific. The Inca Empire was situated in Peru, and the ruins, including the astonishingly beautiful Machu Picchu and the former capital of the Inca Empire, Cusco, are wonderful places to visit.
And were you were able to go there when you were there as an exchange student to see those?
Yes, they made sure that we visited many places.
Oh, wow. What a great experience for teenagers.
It was. It's part of why I consider myself a person who's done nothing but learned and become a better person by living a life that is not just situated in my small block and community, which is rich in itself, and I love my neighborhood, but I also would not be the person I am today if I had not had experiences that, broaden my horizons, basically.
I have a work colleague from Mexico City whose son, I think he's only 15, maybe 16, is an exchange student in Ireland. And it's like, wow, what a, oh man, that's such a long way to go at that age and so different. And but he's thriving there. So
The only thing about that is that I am Irish and I have cousins in Ireland, and it's one of the most bloody cold places I've ever been in my life. It's freezing.
Yeah, and he's like I said, he's from Mexico City, so it's pretty different,
Excellent.
definitely. So Ellen, I see that you're a certified California naturalist, and what exactly does that mean?
It's a really interesting program. There are many states that have this type of program that builds stewardship among people who go through the program. Ours in California is with the University of California out of Davis. And it's a wonderful program where you basically go to a particular ecosystem in California and you spend time there learning everything you can about it. You can choose your local community and do courses and field trips with the program while you're at home, or you can actually go to places like Yosemite. And I went to the Port Reyes National Seashore, and we were there for an entire week studying and doing field trips in the area to learn about that particular system.
Wow,
The
very
purpose
cool.
of the program is to train people and then have them bring it forward in their life and share with others. Most of the people who were on my program were teachers, and so they brought it back to the classroom. At that time, I'd ended my teaching career, but I was on a school board, and so I was able to communicate my experiences that way. But ultimately, I decided that volunteering probably was not for me, but I used what I learned to try to bring forward natural history into my writing.
Absolutely. So now, after this book, Follow the Water, you're kind of staying on this theme of survival in the wilderness.
I am for the next book. I found I'm not a literary writer, and I like nonfiction. But this next book, I'm breaking into fiction based on reality and science. It's called The Siberian, and it's the story of survival of two young people in the far east of Russia and their encounters with the local Siberian tiger.
And it is based on a true story as well.
It is not based on a particular true story,
Okay.
but it
Okay.
is based on the science and what's going on in the region.
I Right. Now, with Follow the Water, one of the, you know, where you're writing about the science, you're writing about the Amazon, and one of the purposes is for readers to really understand how crucial the Amazon is to us as a species, environmentally. Do you want to address that a little bit?
Absolutely. It's known as the lungs of the planet, largest rainforest touching multiple countries under extreme stress and attack. And this is where we get a lot of our oxygen in the world. And it is a resource that if it's destroyed, it will not come back the way it is now. I was reading an interesting fact about the Amazon. In 1 mile, 1 square mile of the Amazon, there are more insect species than in the entire United States. And knowing that type of diversity and the loss that we would face, both genetically and culturally, if we destroy this beautiful gift that we're given, it's just astonishingly horrible. Not only for our own personal survival as living in a healthy, oxygen-filled environment, but also culturally and spiritually, I think.
Wow.
A great loss.
Well, Ellen, why don't you read a little bit for us from Follow the Water?
All right, I will. So the setting is, it is Christmas Eve, and they've gotten on the plane, and they're quite happy because everybody is preparing for a joyous homecoming for Christmas. The flight steadily hums over eastern Peru, and Julianne watches the mountains gradually shrink and then transform into a green blanket of rainforest spreading out to the horizon. The plane begins its descent 20 minutes from landing. In the cockpit, the pilot's chit-chat abruptly stops. The plane's radar anticipated normal summer showers, but ahead of them, a towering black thunderhead knotted together in a violent storm looms menacingly. There had been no word on the radio about such severe conditions over the jungle, and the nose of the plane heads directly towards the storm. The pilots decide they are too close to fly around the squall, and they will lower altitude to avoid the worst of the storm. The seatbelt light switches on, and a stewardess's voice fills the cabin. "Passengers, we inform you that the area of turbulence we are going through is due to a major storm over the Amazon jungle. Fasten your seatbelts, please." The plane flies straight into the oily black clouds. As if a giant hand flicked a light switch, the interior of the cabin plunges into darkness. A collective gasp of surprise and fear comes from the passengers. Violent eddies of air knock the airplane sideways and up and down and tear at its aluminum outer skin. Julianne's mother clutches her hand and their eyes meet. "Hopefully this goes all right," her mother says. Luggage, cakes, flowers, and packages rain down on the passengers from the overhead compartments. Plates and magazines fly through the cabin and drinks shower onto their heads. Outside Julianne's window, threads of lightning crisscross the sky in wild spider webs. And in the burst of light, she sees the clouds whip and streak like crazed beast. In the cabin, the air itself seems black. Passengers call out names, scream and cry for help. Prayers and pleas to God fill the compartment. In the cockpit, the flight crew struggles for control. The wind jerks the plane left and right, and they fight against the storm to keep the yoke level and the plane moving forward. The shell of the fuselage shakes as the wind peels and scrapes at its bolts and seams. Julianne's internal clock stops ticking. She can't tell if 10 minutes or 10 seconds have passed. All her senses and attention fix on the present as she grips her armrests. A crack of thunder and a flash of light explodes outside her window. A bolt of lightning has plowed into the right wing. The brilliant electrical flash blinds her for a moment. Julianne doesn't see the wind buckle and tear off the plane. With no right wing, the plane stops struggling and surrenders to the wind. Julianne's vision returns as the passenger cabin dips forward. Above the wails of terror and the rumble of metal ripping apart, her mother's hand tears away from hers. She hears Maria say clearly, "Now it's all over." The plane lurches into a steep vertical nosedive. The engines scream and roar. The growl and screech of the struggling machine shake Julianne's entire body. She pitches forward through her seatbelt, though her seatbelt holds her in her seat. She can see straight down the aisle. The cockpit door flaps open and the control panels, knobs, and the frantic hands of the pilots are directly below her. The passenger cabin cracks apart in front of Julianne and the entire plane crumbles away from her into the storm. Her window, the other passengers, seats, flying packages, everything disappears. For a moment, still bolted to her seat, she feels herself suspended in midair in a raging thunderstorm 2 miles above the Amazon forest. Two seats are still attached to hers, but they are now empty. The seatbelts flap and snap in the wind. Her mother and the other man are gone. The roaring of the engine stops. She begins to fall.
Wow. Ellen Cochrane reading from Follow the Water. So when you made the decision, you were in your master's program when you were working on this. Did you know immediately what the structure of the book would be, or was that something that developed over time?
This story is extremely famous, and it has been told in multiple versions in many countries. Julianne herself wrote an autobiography. It was for adults. This is for youngsters, fifth grade through high school, and I wanted to bring this story to language and storytelling that would be accessible for them. I thought about how to tell it, and I knew I wanted to be 100% accurate, so I just decided to do a timeline type of approach from start to finish, and did everything I can to see any kind of interviews she did or any kind of reports of actual speech and report it in the story. If it didn't actually come from her or from reported as coming from her in stories, I did not try and guess anything about what was the internal dialogue or what was to other people. I didn't think that'd be appropriate. So it's very factual, but it does tell a rich story from beginning to end.
Yeah. And the sidebars, how'd you decide which things to write sidebars about?
That's actually one of the most fun parts of the book. I love natural history, and I just remember being a youngster and just being fascinated about reading about other creatures. I wanted to give a full picture of what it was like in the Amazon, everything from botany to, you know, the creatures, the zoology and so forth, and the physics. So I wrote about everything that pertained to the story that I thought would engage children the most. And I'm hoping that I did it.
So why don't you read a sample of one of the sidebars too, so we get an idea of that?
Okay, I will do that. And I have to find a really good one to read. And I think I know what it's going to be. It's going to be about bullet ants.
Ooh.
Yes.
Yeah, those sounded terrifying.
They are terrifying. Interesting little side note. There is a pain sting index, and it's rated from 1 to 5. If you remember being stung by a honeybee, that's only a number 3. So the most feared creature in the Amazon forest can send grown men crashing to the ground, howling in agony as the pain it inflicts sears through the body, cascading in waves that don't let up. Its local nickname is 24 hours, because that's how long the torment can last. The culprit? A tiny ant. The bullet ant is one of the largest ants in the world for an ant, but it's still just an ant, about the size of a U.S. quarter. An angry bullet ant will clamp down your skin with powerful mandibles and then eject its venomous stinger, which contains a toxin that affects muscles and nerves. Multiple stings can lead to unconsciousness, but they're not lethal to humans. The real horror is the intense pain, truly as severe as a bullet wound. One indigenous tribe, Amazon tribe, the Sacheré Maué, uses bullet ants in a coming of age ceremony. Ants are collected and placed in a mixture of water and medicinal leaves that contain a natural sedative. The groggy ants are then woven into large reed gloves that look like giant oven mitts. When the ants wake up, they are furious. Adolescent boys slip the gloves onto their hands and endure multiple stings. To complete the initiation, the boys must wear the gloves for 10 minutes at a time. Multiple times over several months, they must not cry out or complain of the pain. This is thought to prepare them for the rigors of adulthood. So back to the sting index, I mentioned that the honeybee was 3. The bullet ant is 5.
Wow. Wow. I can't. They're torturing those poor boys.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so as a former teacher, one of the things, you know, I think you would like to have this book used in the classroom. And what are some of the things that you're doing to assist that? And also, what are some of the lessons that you're hoping kids will take away from the book?
I think I've mentioned before that honesty and truth is very important to young people. And I hope that the book is used to promote science and the idea of discovery through science. I think in this world where, in this current environment, many opinion-based decisions are being made, it's important to let children understand how to go about forming fact-based opinion and learning truth about the world around us. To help that happen, I am developing lesson plans that I will provide for free on my website, and teachers are more than welcome to download them and use this book either in science classes or in English classes. I taught many different subjects, but one of my most enjoyable ones when I was a teacher was teaching English language learners. And this book also adapts really really well for the English language learner. It's told in pretty much the present tense, and it is very accessible with vocabulary and structure for the English learner.
Now, the book is compared to Hatchet, which I remember my kids in school reading that book. I think it came out after my school days, but How would you compare this to Hatchet?
Hatchet is a wonderful story about a boy who does persevere going through a plane crash and then trying to find his way to safety. And I believe he is in the Canadian wilderness. I can't tell you exactly where Paulson placed it. But it's an individual youngster overcoming great odds to survive. And so I think that it compares very well with Follow the Water.
Wow. How did Julianne use her science background to help her survive?
Oh, innumerable ways. She made decisions every step of the way through careful observation. And observation is one of the elements of science. So she was taught by her parents many lessons. Don't touch leaves if you don't know what they are. Don't eat anything unless you're 100% sure. She knew how to start a fire, but she couldn't because it was so sopping wet at that time of year. She endured almost every night rainstorms and crawled on a bank and, you know, hunched over. She knew when she was being besieged by mosquitoes that swatting at them was an expenditure of energy and would not help her, so she just endured. She encountered a giant spider at one point which is as large as a human hand, which is eaten by many local people in the jungle, but she didn't have any way to cook it, so she bypassed it. But she actually considered, maybe I should eat that spider.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness.
And at the very end of her ordeal, she had found a woodcutter's hut, and she was starving and exhausted, and she collapsed on the floor. And still no people, but there were dozens and dozens of little frogs, and she knew the poison dart frog in the Amazon is very dangerous. But she was calculating, well, maybe if I just ate two or one, I would get some energy, and it wouldn't kill me.
Oh my goodness.
Decision making every step of the way, and I delighted in talking about and writing about this because young people are so filled with intellectual energy, ideas, and the ability to see the world. Too often we dismiss some of their discoveries, and they can really come out with some wonderful information. I'm actually working on another idea right now about young people and scientific discoveries. And through the research, I found that many young people have contributed to papers, discovered things astronomically, and have had fresh set of eyes that have helped working scientists.
Oh, I know. I've read some really amazing things that young scientists have invented or discovered that are real. Yeah, it's everybody should know about.
Yes.
Absolutely. Now, I noticed on your website which is ellencochrane.com, and ELLENCOCHRANE,
Yes.
that you have three books shown there. So the one we're talking about today, Follow the Water, and then The Siberian, and then a third one, Ginger Snap, to be released in 2028. So does that mean that you got a three-book deal?
No, it does not. That means I'm
Okay.
working on my ideals for the other two books that I'm
Okay.
writing.
Okay.
Ginger Snap is meant for a younger audience, and it's a more whimsical book about a cat that possesses some magical attributes, has no idea how to use them.
Oh. And you have and the covers of these books are really great. Were you involved at all in the cover design for Follow the Water?
It's very interesting. No, the people in publishing know their business so well.
Yes, yeah.
They researched what kind of cover would appeal, and they chose color and facial expression and subtle clues throughout the cover that they knew would appeal to young readers. So the other two covers, they are a friend of mine helped put them together, but she looked carefully at Follow the Water. She's not a professional, but she is able to put them together and help me do it. The Ginger Snap is actually kind of an interesting cover because it's based on a photograph here in Sacramento. A friend of mine, Allison Goebbels, who is a photographer, walked out of her house one morning and took a picture of a coyote in the middle of the city chasing a cat up a tree. She got several photographs of it, so that photo was adapted to make that cover.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. So, Ellen, let's talk a little bit about your writing process. Do you write solely on computer? Do you write by hand at all? Do you outline?
I do not write by hand at all, only on the computer. I use Microsoft Word, and I'm a research wonk, and so get inspired by something I researched and then go madly insane and go to every URL I can find and every Google Scholar paper I can find about the subject, and then amass a sheet of paper with the destinations. And then I start reading more slowly through them and picking out the most interesting aspects, deciding the story I'm going to write. And I'm mainly a nonfiction writer, so the Siberian's a bit of a challenge because I'm having to work on dialogue. And my dialogue initially was like, "Stop! It's dangerous." So I'm trying to work on authenticity, which is kind of funny, but.
Well, in Follow the Water, you had a little bit of dialogue, but since for most of the book, Julianne's all by herself, she has no one to talk to.
Yes, the dialogue that I had was plucked from some of it was from her autobiography, trying to be intensely accurate, and then other comments that people reported were made at the time. So it was, I had a bit of a fear because like I said earlier, it is her story. I'm not trying to tromp on this. I wanted to bring the story to young people and tell it in a way that made them interested in the scientific world.
Have you gotten any feedback? I know it's the as we're recording this, the book hasn't been published yet, but have you gotten any feedback from the foundation?
No, not yet. They're kind of in a jam right now with what's going on.
Oh yeah, no kidding.
I haven't talked to them, but after the book comes out, I'll be sure to send out a copy and hope that when she reads it, that she's pleased with the effort and understands the intent.
Yeah. Okay, so do you outline for a book?
That's an interesting question. I outline-ish. Don't really, it's not formal, but I project forward what's going to happen next. It's interesting you asked me this because I never really thought about how I do this. But what I do is I will write down like chapters, headings, and then I'll make notes about what I think will probably come up in that chapter.
Well,
And
that's
then
an outline.
I hope for the best.
And you probably change it as you go.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But when you write fact-based, the factual stories kind of tell themselves as you go forward. So you've got all your information, you're just trying to communicate it in a way that makes sense and that's interesting.
Right. Do you do, are you a, someone who writes very quickly and then and doesn't edit while they go, or are you someone who is editing and refining as you go?
I'm a quick writer and then go back and fix everything.
And how many drafts would you say you do?
It's interesting because when you write on the computer,
Yeah, it's often not complete drafts, but
yeah, and also I don't track my drafts, which is maybe something I should do, but all the changes that you make after you send your draft into the publisher, of course, they come back with their edits and suggestions and they track intensely. Microsoft Word with the column on the right where you can see everything in red that they did. The other thing that's really fascinating that I didn't know about in publishing houses is they send you a style sheet and it establishes people's names, capitalizations, and the style sheet gets carried through, of course, through the whole book. But things you didn't think of, like, did I use the word Kleenex? And is that a proper noun or is that a company name? That's not my book, but that's the kind of gist of what the style sheet is.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. How did you know when the book was ready to send off? And obviously you had a professional editing afterwards, so it wasn't completely final, but when did you know that it, okay, this is as good as I'm going to get it on my own?
It was accepted as a master's thesis, and that was the first solid version. That was used by the agent to sell it, and then I got into the hands of the most intelligent, amazing people I've ever met, and those are professional copy editors in publishing houses. They talk about a whole different world of accuracy and intelligence when you go through a manuscript. Everything was questioned, everything was verified. Because this is a nonfiction, you when you have a reputation like Little Brown, you have to make sure everything is accurate. And they went through it really almost letter by letter. I was impressed and amazed, and it really improved the book.
Wow. You must have felt very fortunate to get a contract with Little Brown right out with on your first effort, let's say.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful publishing house, and publishers are besieged now with everything that's going on with the computer advancements. But they are so good at what they do. I feel extremely fortunate. Traditional publishing contract is not something that is easy to get these days.
Absolutely. Speaking of all the changes, how is AI going to affect, do you use AI at all in your research, and how will it affect your future as a writer?
Well, the first thing, harking back to a Ronald Reagan comment, when you use AI, trust but verify. And the answer, yes, I do, and quite happily use AI for research. I also use Google Scholar, but AI often will get me straight to sources without as much digging as I used to do. But once you get that, the AI makes a lot of mistakes, and you have to make sure that everything that you hear from AI is actually true. So you have to really trust but verify.
Right, right. And then, of course, there's the whole environmental impact of using AI.
Yes. Are you talking about
the use of water, power? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm actually a proponent of AI, but like any new systems that humans develop and use, there's a huge educational component that has to be started early and often, starting with our young people and then the old cotton heads that are out here like me. We also have to extend that education. So it's not just, the boogeyman that's going to get you, but another tool developed by humans, and here's how you responsibly use it.
So one last question for you, Ellen. How can young readers use what they might learn from this book about survival to help survive our modern challenges?
And not a direct correlation, because she was fighting for her life in a wild environment. But resilience is something that's very important. And she was extremely resilient. And I was always impressed with my students and younger people in general, the resilience, whether it's taking a terrible tumble and coming back from it and healing, or psychological resilience after difficult times. So in their personal lives, they can exercise a lot of resilience that Julianne demonstrates in the book. In the world in general, that's such a difficult question. You know, our young people, everything from school shootings to where the world is going, led by leaders, you may question their ability to take us safely forward. It is extremely difficult. Parenting is, I think, the most important job in the world, and a rough job for parents now, but just give kids the tools of resiliency and the ability to learn about the world honestly. And I think that's a foundation for helping them.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us today, Ellen. I'm going to close with a quote from Isabel Allende. We don't even know how strong we are until we are forced to bring that hidden strength forward. In times of tragedy, of war, of necessity, people do amazing things. The human capacity for survival and renewal is awesome.
I love that. Yeah. I love the idea of renewal. I think we are all phoenixes waiting to
rise. Well, thank you again, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you so much.